You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 314, Juliet and the incident with a cafe owner. We look into cafeteria etiquette and we investigate the excruciating world of banter. Bant, yeah, great. And we contemplate whether it's time to pension off Blue Peter. Oh no, I did see it yesterday though. It's all coming up right after Joe and I are trading and down to zero. All the feeling when you're reeling, you step lightly thinking you're number one, down to zero with a word, leaving for another one.
Walks through the crowd and takes your man, sends you rushing to the mirror, but your eyebrows and say, there's more beauty in you than anyone. I remember who walked the warm sand beside you, more to your heel, let the waves come and rush in. She took the worry from your head, but then again, she put trouble in your heart instead. Then you fall down to the ground, down to the ground. You know how it ends. Still more crying when you're thinking of your mother's only son. Take to your bed, you set this peace and sleep, but you dream of love instead. All the heartache you'll find can bring pain that a best are in song.
I've made an idiot of myself many times in my life.
I find this hard to believe.
So kind of you. Yeah, I mean, it really is. But, you know, it has happened. One of those times was in the summer of 1976 when I was having lunch with a friend of mine in a restaurant called Asterisk at the
Was everybody dressed as a French Viking?
Well, it's funny you say that because it was themed on that.
Yeah,
they had murals all over the wall.
Oh, that's so good.
Of Asterisk.
I presume it's long since passed.
Long gone. And it was a crêperie and they only served crepes.
This sounds like my dream restaurant. I am very jealous that you got to go to this and that I did not get this experience.
It was at the cheap end of the King's Road in Chelsea. Now, a few tables away, Joan Armour Trading was lunching on her own, and instead of leaving her to it, in 1976, we felt it was the right thing to do with the bravado of youth to go over and tell her how much we loved her and her music. But luckily, she was very kind and patient and didn't tell us off for disturbing her lunch. So,
well, that's yeah. nice. But I think it's okay as long as you're nice and respectfully nice. So that's very pleasant.
Oh, we were very nice. From that year, 1976, Joan Armour Trading and Down to Zero.
I can tell you a short story about this. I think, was this from the album Me, Myself and I? I think it might have been. So me and a couple of friends of mine, they are big record collectors and they are big boot fair enthusiasts as a result. And the three of us went to various boot fairs, and we went to one once, and I was introduced to the crazy world of the £1 challenge. I don't know if you've ever played.
No, I don't know this. No,
but the idea is that the three of you, or rather the members of your party, go to the boot sale, and you will all have to buy a present for each other. I think this is a very warm-hearted game.
Yeah, sweet. Personally. Yeah.
Down to Zero, not on this album, by the way, but it's still relevant because it's Joan Armour Trading related. So
we're I didn't want to correct you. It was from the album Joan Armour Trading, but I thought I'm not gonna ruin
you're a straight up kind of guy, Tez. But anyway, so we had this budget of £1 each, and the male and female couple that I was with, and the male chap, and we will go on to speak about banter later on, but I'd say he was good humoured without tipping to banter, this chap. And so we had to go off and do this thing, and I managed to find him a World's Best Grandad mug that I won on the Tombola, which I was very, very pleased by. It had a can of Apple Tango in it as well, so clearly the ultimate prize. And they are Crystal Palace supporters, and I found some programmes for them and various things. The lady of the couple bought me an excellent fish made out of shells, on the basis that if one lives in Hastings, one has to own these things.
Indeed,
which
makes
perfect sense. And the chap, he said to me, I want you to know that I'm embracing the fact that you go out with women rather than men, which started to make me hyperventilate already because I worried what was coming. He gave me a copy of Lesbian Vampire Killers on DVD, and when I expressed unhappiness at this, admitted that he himself had never actually made it to the end of the film. And he also gave me a Joan Armour Trading LP, because he felt that was another way of embracing my sexuality. So every Lord. Time I get that LP out, I always think of my wacky friend Paul and his clumsy attempts to embrace the somewhat cliched world of lesbian music tastes.
Some would say ill-judged, but I wouldn't want to interfere.
Actually, to be fair, I found it funny because Paul is a very good friend of mine, and so I thought it was quite entertaining. So yes, Joan Armour Trading. Venerated perhaps amongst certain levels of society, but I have to say she's made some damn good records, so all was well.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 314.
Intervention still not withcoming.
There's just no stopping us. I'm Terence Dackham, and here's a woman whose Instagram account will almost certainly prove she owns more shirts than you. It's Juliet Harris.
That was never the point. I don't know what the point of it was originally. As a friend of mine put it the other day, where is this going? The answer is sort of, well, to the laundrette, I suspect, at some point. But there was never a point to show off about how many shirts I had. It was just, and it was a protest against selfies, because you never see my face in it. You just see a little bit of glasses and my shoulder. And the idea was, well, that was kind of...
You're an attractive woman. It's a shame.
That's just very kind. I think that is what they call a minority view. But I'm extremely fond of your support as ever, if anyone's interested in pictures of my shirts, SuperJules84 is the way to go to Instagram, and I cannot believe that we've got self-promotion in with less than 5 minutes of the podcast already passed, but you know, here we are.
Now, the whole concept of eating out or even stopping off for a coffee has changed completely in my admittedly lengthy lifetime. When I was a small boy growing up in the suburbs, no one went out to eat lunch. The only time people ate in a restaurant or a hotel was at a wedding. And there was only one restaurant in my town where I grew up in, and it was always empty. And the idea of there being special cafes where you went to drink a coffee, eat a sandwich, would have been laughable. But in my lifetime, all this has changed completely. We Brits have imported the American lifestyle of cafes and restaurants in every town, catering pretty much for all budgets and tastes. However, with every new-ish innovation, especially in England, comes a new set of social rules. And this week, Jules, you've been testing the rules of etiquette of behaviour in cafe society.
I have. have, although in a way, I think this might be a tale as old as time. This is a tale of family ethics and perhaps class as well, as much as it is, you know, the act of going out. So I work in a seaside town called Bexhill. I feel that this is not compromising my personal safety to express that. There are a number of very pleasant seafront cafes. And you say that people don't really go out for coffee. One way in which I think is different, and I think has always been different, is if one goes on holiday to the seaside. And I think that this family in question were doing just that. They had accents that we live on the Bexhill is on the south coast, and they had accents that were Midlandsy, I think. And the impression that I got, so it's a party at the table. There were, I would say, four or five adults and a couple of very small children. And it had the look of me, of grandparents, parents and kids. And they were all having a lovely time. I was having a cup of tea and a hot sausage roll, because my body is a temple, during my lunch break at work. And so it was a very nice, beautiful day. Nice little cafe, kind of out of a shed, really. This is the same cafe that caused you distress when I posted a picture once about it with a blackboard. They're saying they sold chips, and there was a blackboard with various unusual vegetable based burgers on it.
Which you were not a fan of, if I remember correctly.
Right. But anyway, they sell normal things too. So I was in my sausage roll, and the cafe had it was well appointed, and it had a large sort of plastic bucket full of children's toys. And the idea was that if you brought children to the cafe, they could play with some of the toys that belonged to the cafe, which I'm very much in favour of. I think that's lovely. So there was I'm awful at ageing children, but I'd say this kid was no older than two and probably younger than that, who had been given a very small, and I think actually looking back on it, I doubt this was suitable for kids under three anyway, but that is not relevant. This very small car, there used to be something called micro machines that I was very fond of when I was younger, which are basically very, very small cars. They're maybe about an inch or two long. And it was a yellow car. It had seen some life, I think. It was not in particularly good condition. That's not a criticism, that's just where it was. And this small child was very, very taken with this car, very taken, and had spent a long time quietly playing with it and you know, was sat on someone's lap and was reasonably well behaved and all that kind of stuff. And they'd had a nice lunch. I'd had quite a nice lunch, actually. And the time had come for them to go, obviously. And so the cafe owners came over to collect payment for the bill and to collect up the toys, which the parents were willing to offer over. They went to take this yellow car from this small child, and a noise which was akin with a jumbo jet taking off then came out of this child, who was in extreme distress at having this car taken away. And there was loads and loads of screaming to the point where my tolerance levels, which I suspect are higher than yours, were beginning to become broached. So eventually the car was retrieved and put back in the box. The people paid and then they went. But shortly after they went, the grandfather of the group, who I'd say was a man in his late, you know, probably in his 60s, came back and said to the cafe owners, "Can I give you £1 for the small yellow car, please?"
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the cafe owners said, "No, sorry, that's one of our toys." And he said, "Oh, okay." And one was ready. I mean, they weren't horrible, but they were not particularly friendly. So he said, "Okay, fine, all right, never mind. Thanks very much anyway," and left. The cafe owners, who I'd say, and this is where I think there's a class dimension, I don't mean this to sound snobbish, but the people were, I would describe them as ordinary. I would not say they were even, you know, middle class particularly. They all seemed very pleasant, the family. They were just on holiday, on a seaside holiday, and I would say they were relatively ordinary. If you want to define that as working class, fine, but I'd say they were fairly ordinary. The people running the cafe were ordinary as well. And the two women, the older woman and the younger woman, who I think may have been mother and daughters, then started talking behind me about their attitude was basically, old people think they can buy themselves out of any situation. And the child was terribly spoilt. And, you know, and that was that, really. And my view on this, once upon a time, I might have thought, if they'd been middle class, I probably would have taken the attitude, oh, yeah, typical people think they can buy their way out of anything. But my view was that these people were not middle class. In a way, I thought it was slightly hilarious that the people that ran the cafe were trying to put themselves, it was almost like a 70s sitcom, they were trying to put themselves above the holiday makers, when in fact they were all pretty much from the same, they were coming from the same direction, I think. And I thought that it was needless to refuse the man's request. I thought they weren't asking for it to be given to them. I think a pound was a severe overestimation of the value of the small car, to be honest. If it was a jumble sale, I'd have felt swindled if I was asked for more than 20p, frankly. And I thought that it was chippy, and I thought that it lacked kindness, and you know what, it was a small yellow car in a bucket of, in a larger bucket of toys that belonged to the cafe. It had clearly brought a great deal of enjoyment to that small child. It wasn't like the cafe was full of families with small children who then would have set a bad example. I just thought it was needless, really, and I felt that it wouldn't have taken a lot for them to go, all right then, and you know, taken the pound and given them the small car. Am I being too soft, Terence, or you know, what was the child being spoilt, and were the family thinking they could buy their way out of things, or am I right on this?
I don't think you can be spoilt at 18 months, 2 years old. It's just it's a kind of primeval thing. You've been given something, and you think, oh, this, it gives you pleasure, and you think it's yours, and then to sort of someone come and take it away again, it's probably going to give him psychological damage for the rest of his life. It's horrible. If it had been some sort of collector's edition of a dinky toy or yes, something, that fair enough, but as you say, some sort of manky mashed up little car,
it didn't look in great nick, to be honest, and
to be fair, they could have gone to a car boot sale this Sunday and picked up another 100 of those cars, probably, as you say, for £5 for 100,
probably, so yeah,
you know, absolutely
so
pompous, needless, causing harm to a family, and it's very difficult when you get to, this is always in a confined situation. An aeroplane is the worst.
Nothing. Kids on planes.
Yeah. Same, you know, it's similar in cafes, but there is at least an escape route. When kids play up, I always do feel rather sorry for the parents, although I'm probably the most frowning person in the establishment.
Yes, we'd have got up and left, wouldn't we? Surely.
Oh, definitely. Yes. With a few toots, you know. As I went, but
you know, hip, yes,
exactly. But on the other hand, you know, you do feel terribly sorry for parents in that situation, or as you said, grandparents trapped in that situation. And I thought when you told us that story there, I thought, what a lovely touch that the grandfather came back and sort of still, you know, even though the child was probably getting over it, thought, I'll please little Billy by, you know, retrieving the car. This is the problem. The way other people behave is one of the primary reasons I'm such a misanthrope. I was just saying, as a nation, as a whole, we've just become more selfish and self-centred, like your cafe owners. And I tell you what, this becomes more noticeable about how we behave here. When you go abroad, almost anywhere in Europe, small town America, especially in Ireland, people are far more socially aware and generally kinder. And it saddens me to hear that story, because what did those two women get out of that than rather a kind of smug feeling of, oh, we showed them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the vibe that I got. I mean, I could be wrong, but that was the impression, just as a kind of a hapless passerby sat there, that, you know, that was the impression that I got, really. And I think if I was in that position, who knows, maybe they have picked Bexhill as their regular holiday place, because I grew up, I mean, perhaps I don't know, but I suspect my background was not entirely dissimilar to that family. We used to go on seaside holidays a lot when I was younger. I never went abroad with my parents. We always went somewhere in Britain, and we used to go to Suffolk a lot, and we often used to go to Great Yarmouth in a sort of a day trip, and which I loved, and I still love Great Yarmouth as a result of that. And I almost, again, when we talked about Justine Greening last week, and I said that it felt very real to me, this story, because we had similar backgrounds, and that's why I kind of, you know, it stung a bit for me, because it felt a bit close to home. Here, I felt, you know, pretty aggrieved on behalf of the family, because I could almost picture that happening if we'd gone to somewhere like Tenby in Wales, where we used to go a lot, or Great Yarmouth, or any of those seaside towns. I could easily, I was pretty well behaved. My mum was telling me yesterday she felt that I was very well behaved and a good girl as a child and a teenager.
I find this very hard to believe, but I'll take your word for it.
Well, she said I was most problematic in my 20s, which I found pretty insulting, really. But for various reasons that we've talked about on the podcast previously. But anyway, so So actually, that could easily have happened to us if we'd gone somewhere. And I do feel that, like you say, it upset me, actually. And I don't usually get upset about things, but I found it a bit of a pity that if I was in that family and I was taking kids, you know, to somewhere, if we went back to Bexhill again, I wouldn't go back to that cafe.
Oh, no.
Because it would leave an unpleasant taste in my mouth. And you feel like saying to the cafe, look, they might not ever come back. But if they did, or if they had friends that said that, if you said, oh, we had a lovely time in Bexhill, and they'd have friends go, well, we might go on holiday there. Where do you think we should go and eat? Where's good to go? For the sake of accepting a pound, the cafe could have cost themselves many more pounds in terms of custom. And I find that really odd. I mean, there is a counter argument to this, that, you know, the lesson is that if you scream and scream for stuff that isn't yours, then why should that entitle you to it? And I can't, you know, that's the argument I think.
Yeah, if you're 15, but this child was like 18 months or something.
I know. And also, you know, I just thought it was, like you say, it was mean-spirited. And I thought that, you know, if the guide said, I'd give you 10p for it, then that might have been. But the fact that he was paying somewhat over the odds, I think, for something which I think was one of many toys for them. And it was very, obviously very special, oddly, to this small child. You know, small child logic is always hard to unpick. But it was fairly clear here what the indicator was. And so yeah, I just... I'm sorry to start the podcast with a bit of a bum note, but I was quite interested to know whether or not it was me being exceptionally soft here, or whether it is mean-spirited and depressing. And on a truly bouncy note, it would seem you've concluded that it is mean-spirited and depressing.
Mean-spirited.
So welcome to the podcast, everyone. Yes.
I wonder at what stage their morals would have switched, though, because if I'd have been that man, and if I'd have had a few bob, I would have said, all right, 10 quid. And they'd gone, no, all right, 100 quid. And sort of test their resolve. Even if I then said no, F you, and walked out, it would have been interesting to see at what point they said, yeah, all right, have the car. What was their price? The price of their pompous moral stance, I suspect, would have changed the more that
that funny? It just goes to show that, you know, and that would have been very entertaining, because given that the root of their objections seemed to be, oh, why do people think we can be bought? It would have been very funny if they then turned out to have been bought.
Exactly. All the lads having a bit of bants. Is there anything...
the banter bus is coming, people.
Is there anything worse in the whole world? That's next, right after Heim.
record so much. I saw someone having a conversation about this on Twitter the other day, and their view was that they weren't fans and that they could never remember any of the songs. And isn't it strange how people who perhaps like similar music in some senses, how their tastes can differ? Because I think this whole album, this is Don't Save Me, by the way, by Haim, and it comes from their debut album, or their first full-length album in any event. And I have to say that I put it on when I want a good sing. If I want it's from Days Are Gone, their debut album. And I have to say, if I want to have a good old sing, I know all these songs really well, including that, and I just think they're a class act. So isn't it weird how people don't always necessarily hear the same things? But no, they played at Glastonbury again this year, flogging their new album, which is out shortly. And I just think they're brilliant. I'm a huge fan of anybody that wants to revive Fleetwood Mac style adult pop, and their sisters as well, which I think is quite fun. And I'm just an enormous fan. So not for everybody, but very much for me.
Yeah, I agree. And they certainly know how to write a tune. As they say, anyone who's ever felt uncomfortable by the behaviour and words of other people, and perhaps has shown the courage to confront it, may very well have found their concerns batted away by the response of, "Oh, it's just banter, man, you can't even have a laugh these days." And they may go on to say that you want to bring in Sharia law and that you're a living example of political correctness.
Everyone is now a lesbian. Yes,
that's right. Well, the whole banter thing, Jules, it seemed to have found its blue touch paper in the late 90s with the appearance of the new lads magazines like Maxim and Loaded, pushed onwards by the likes of Badil and Skinner, and reached its peak with the Weasley lols of Dapper Laughs. Are we now at peak bants, Jules?
Well, one can only hope, because of course the implication of a peak is that it will then trough afterwards. So I sincerely hope we are. It is very odd, isn't it? The reason that we're talking about this is that I saw an excellent piece in The Guardian. They have something in My Guardian. They have a thing called The Long Read. And often it's worth subscribing to, actually, this piece, because it's really good, I think. And they examine a different thing each week, and they're inevitably really interesting articles. And this week, this is by Archie Bland, and it's called The Age of Banter. And the sort of sub headline is, "It used to be a word, the byline is, used to be just a word, now it is a way of life, but is it time to get off the banter bus?" And he talks, like you say, about the idea that these sort of lads magazines came in the 90s, and I think this is in a way harks back again to a class issue that Loaded. The headline for Loaded was the description was for men who should know better. And was that it was pitched at, you know, young professional men, perhaps men that are not Tatler class, but, you know, equally perhaps Guardian reading men, I would say. We had the concept of the new lad around that time. And I remember Graham Coxon from Blur being particularly critical about it. And he said that he was quoted as saying once it was all right to kick someone's head in as long as you could write an essay about it. And I think that what started off as a kind of middle class fun pursuit, and I think there are parallels with Corbynism here as well, actually, what started off as kind of middle class people, then once it trickles down, it then becomes something that, isn't it funny how one man's irony and self-knowing is another man's unshakable Bible? And I think that's how it's kind of ended up mutating into something that is very unpleasant. Speaking from a feminist perspective, you know, it seems to be harder to be a teenage girl in some respects than it ever has been. You get terrible reports of what goes on in schools, the kind of the increasingly iron grip of pornography amongst young teenagers. You really should not be experiencing this stuff, I don't think. And it's not just a case of magazines being passed around anymore. The internet has had a really malign influence, I think, and sort of shaming of teenage girls and terrible things like that. And I do lay a lot of that at the door of quote unquote banter, because this idea that, and in a way that's very traditional, women have always been kind of portrayed as quote unquote tight, haven't they, even since the 60s, if you know, you can't take a joke or whatever. And you know, I find it increasingly dispiriting. But actually, funnily enough, in a way it's kind of an offshoot of fragile masculinity as well, I think, because there's a this long article that's written by Archie Bland is kind of based around a night out that he's experiencing with some seemingly terrible chaps who spun an internet yarn about how the fact that they'd ended up in Syria by accident, and actually that wasn't the case at all. And there's a good paragraph in it which I'm struggling to find now, but basically it's all based out around the idea that men seem to find it impossible, young men seem to find it increasingly impossible just to be friends, and that, you know, you cannot, men find it, it seems to be, find it hard to express their emotion about how much, you know, they
good
love
point.
Their friends.
Very
and
good
so
point.
It falls down this kind of idea of banter. And in a way, I don't so much have a problem with that, although it's not nice when people are unpleasant to each other. And I think that often there are certain men that find, that perhaps are shyer, that find this harder to go along with. And I think, you know, this isn't just something that hurts women. I think this is something that can hurt men sometimes as well. Absolutely. But I do, it is a pity that as well as men suffering the after effects of men not being able to deal with friendship very well and not being able to deal with masculinity very well, it's a pity that is so impacted on women as well as men. And I think that you know, there is a really dark, I don't want to seem like something completely humorless feminist, because I don't think I am at all, but I think there's a dark side to this which I find difficult to deal with and which I resent. And actually, I don't think that the likes of Loaded and Fantasy Football League were any better, really, than the Men Behaving Badly were any better, really, than the likes of Nuts and Zoo. But you know, which is the kind of the distorted facsimile of those sort of magazines. But I know, I like you say, I find it really hard and really worrying, because I think that I always find it concerning when unpleasantness, which is what a lot of what banter is really, is dressed up as kind of a laugh. And then that way, that makes it extremely difficult to argue against, because you are accused of being humorless. And it's like, I'm not being humorless. I just don't think this is pleasant or acceptable. And actually, quite a lot of it is just unpleasant and not funny. And I would use, you know, this is the culture that spawned awful people like Dapper Laughs.
Absolutely.
It was the comedian that was, you know, eventually had his show taken away for various unpleasant, you know, rape insinuations about women. And I don't see that as humour at all. I think it's deeply, deeply unpleasant.
I absolutely loathe every single aspect of banter culture. I can find no redeeming features. One always has to put a caveat in, like you did. And I have to, you know, I like nothing more than being in the company of people who make me laugh. And even sometimes me making other people laugh. It's great. There's no, you know, it's the best medicine, as they say, isn't it? But that certainly doesn't mean falling back on a lazy strategy of just making fun of someone. And banter, it seems to me, to be based on picking on physical characteristics of others and highlighting them, making wounding comments, but as long as you have a
it's
leery
sort of bullying,
grin.
Really, isn't it?
It is bullying, of course. And when this inevitably goes wrong, I mean, what you know, see Jeremy Clarkson, Ricky Gervais, Richard Keys. They always fall back on that, oh, it was just banter. But that leaves behind hurt, wounded, or just plain angry people in their wake. But yeah, banter is, as you say, it's bullying, and I hate it.
Yeah, and isn't it funny how it all banter always seems to, it never stays light. It always seems to end up heavy. And actually, there's a good quote in this Guardian article, I think, from the comedian Bridget Christie. And actually, you know, she's obviously, you know, well known as a feminist. Her show, A Bic for Her, was very groundbreaking, won the Perrier Award at Edinburgh, whatever they're calling it now at Edinburgh. And her quote says, and actually, Maybe. She's right here in that she thinks there is a distinction between types of banter. And she might be right, she might be wrong, but let's hear this quote. So she says, it comes down to context and intent, says the comedian Bridget Christie. The gentler form of banter is still knocking around, she suggested, but it now exists alongside something darker. I found the in-betweeners adolescent banter hilarious because it was equal and unthreatening. There is obviously a world of difference between a group of teenage boys benignly taking the piss out of each other and a bigot being racist or misogynist and trying to pass it off as a joke. And I think this is my concern here, that, you know, obviously you and I are both football fans, and I think we've both played football, and obviously when you play in team sports, sometimes the humour is rather salty, and in order to build a bond between a team, sometimes there is that element in. But this Guardian article goes on to say, and this is interesting, I think, and this is where I think the loaded stuff happened in the 90s, and it very much fits, I think, with the political rise of New Labour at the time and the kind of change in culture. And you can compare, I think, the attitude towards Morrissey waving a Union Jack around in 1990, which is very negative, to the attitude of Noel Gallagher's Union Jack guitar and Jerry Halliwell's dress at the Brits in 97, I think it was, which you know were widely accepted. Something really moved in those 7 years. It says here, trace the rise of banter and you will find that it corresponds to the rise of political correctness, or anyway to the backlash against political correctness gone mad. That phrase and just banter mirror each other perfectly, one denoting a priggish culture that is deemed to have overreached, the other a laid-back culture that is deemed to have been unfairly reined in. Ironically enough, just banter does exactly what it accuses political correctness of, seeking to close down discussion by telling you that meaning is settled by category rather than content. Political correctness asserts that a racist joke is primarily racist, whereas banter asserts that a racist joke is primarily a joke. In the past, the men who used it rarely had to define it or explain themselves to anybody else. Today, in contrast, it is named all the time. The biggest change isn't the banter itself, says somebody called Beth and Ben. Well, it's the explicit use of the word as a disclaimer. And this article goes on to talk about Morky McKay, who I think we've complained about before. He'd been fired of the manager of Cardiff City Football Club in 2013. He was caught having sent texts that referred to Chinese people eating dogs, black people being criminals, Jewish people being avaricious, and gay people being snakes, all of which were optimistically defended by the League Managers Association as letting off some steam to a friend during some friendly text message banter. And I think, actually, I'm inclined to agree with Bridget Christie that there is a certain level of Mickey taking between men, between friends, particularly men, but not always, that has kind of always existed. But in a way, it seems like the banter culture has tried to piggyback that, and in a way, elements of banter culture, you know, are always racist, are always sexist, are always homophobic, and not in a kind of a political correctness gone mad type way, but in a way that I think is wrong, and I think a lot of decent people is wrong. And I think, like I said earlier, there are a lot of who I would consider decent men who get dragged along with this. A typical example, a friend of mine's husband was talking about this the other day, a nice chap, I would say, was, you know, fairly lefty, fairly feminist, very pleasant bloke, who went out for drinks with his work. And the men from his work went out to drinks, and he left in the end because he said he could feel himself being pulled along with this kind of laddie culture. And, you know, if he is a fair example, which I think he is, you know, like I say, I think that banter culture is piggybacking on something harmless. It's something far more malign, and I think that it serves both men and women very badly indeed.
The thing about the Malky McKay bits is saying, oh, it was just private, you know, banter, if you like, between men in private. I think the big test for this is always, yes, but what if the people that you're talking about or making jokes about saw these jokes?
Absolutely.
Now, if they, you know, if individuals or in this context ethnic groups were to sit and say, ha, ha, yes, well then that's fine.
Dolls,
but of course the reality is if people had seen those Malky McKay emails, they would be horrified and hurt.
Absolutely.
And that's the problem. It's all about the impact. If what you say to somebody else makes them laugh and it's a genuine laugh, then that's fine. But if they then go away afterwards and they're weeping into their pillow at night by hurt, then you've got it wrong. I think the really important, really important thing you said, I think, is that it seems to be all about the current age that we live in, men's fear of interaction and emotions, and letting boys letting other boys know that they like them, even love them. They're fearful of that, and therefore establish friendships by this way that these lads did on this night out in that piece by Archie Bland, of basically, in a nice way of putting it, winding each other up. And I think it also has its impact on boys with girls these days. Instead of building a friendship with a girl, and then maybe something happens out of that and you become then boyfriend and girlfriend and onwards, they can't do that anymore. So there's the first thing that young boys tend to do now when they come across a girl that they might like is to tease them and throw banter at them.
Absolutely. And I think as well, to link into something I said earlier on, that is not helped by, you know, the rise and malign influence of pornography, I don't think. And I'm not saying,
because
this is quite a large debate that's happening, amongst feminists at the moment. And there are, you know, there are some people that think it is wrong to completely ban pornography, and there are some people that think it's wrong that it isn't banned. And, you know, there's a big debate going around sort of sex workers and all that sort of thing. I am not anti-pornography per se. It's not something that I particularly do, but I think people should be, you know, allowed to express themselves as they wish. But I think that there is an age at which that is too young and at which that warps you. And I remember a quote by Tony Parsons. I'm not a big fan of Tony Parsons nowadays for lots of reasons, but he said something which just really stuck with me, I thought. And again, when often talking about these issues, it often pops into my mind that he said once, about when asked about sort of internet pornography culture, that he said when he was about 13 or 14 and kind of struggling to talk to women, he said, I kind of had to get past that, because that was the only way you could talk to women, was by kind of, you know, trying to find a way through. He said, if you'd have told me that I could go onto a magic box in my spare room and that I'd be able to look at, you know, naked pictures and naked videos of women on the internet, I'd probably still be there doing that now. And the idea that, you know, that in a way, having instant access to these sort of things online, I think, has really skewed young men and young women's expectations, I think, and perceptions of what is acceptable, you know, what should be expected of them. And I think that, you know, the pressure on young women now is almost unimaginable, really. I mean, I feel slightly removed from this in that I am gay and have been since, you know, a relatively young age. So in a way, I've never had to get into that kind of jungle. But I mean, you know, I have my, you know, there are similar, you know, there are pressures on being a gay woman, don't get me wrong. But in a way, I think that you know, women, men now, young boys, I think you say that, you know, they don't strike up this kind of friendship. I think because in a way the internet is, and these magazines are suggesting to them that they don't have to, because, you know, they are entitled. And I think it's a sense of entitlement as well to this kind of, you know, instant access to women. And equally, I cannot believe it, there are pressures being put on girls age 12, 13, 14 to resemble, you know, women that feature in adult films, and to modify their bodies as a result of that. And I find that, and I think this is all part of the same problem. I think that banter and this are all kind of feeding into the same issue. You could also make a political point, which I think I will, about the coalition government and now the Conservative government, and how there have been lots of research done by the House Commons Library by people like Yvette Cooper about how cuts are falling disproportionately on women rather than men. And it was very interesting. I was talking to a young man who's a member of the Conservative Party last weekend, which is not conversations I often have, but I met him at a barbecue, and he was going out with a friend of mine. He seemed pleasant enough, and he admitted that, he said, we have an enormous problem with our voters at the moment in the Tory party, that we don't, you know, women, particularly women of kind of middle of 30 to 49, we can't get them at the moment. And I did actually say to him, well, stop your austerity cuts falling disproportionately on them and the elderly people for which they care and the children for which they care, and perhaps then you will find yourselves with more success. So in a way, it does feel like women are being maligned in lots of ways, and it is them that are large victims of the banter culture, the, you know, the pornography on the internet and pressure on teenage girls, and and, you know, cuts to, you know, any support they may get from the state for various things. And, you know, and like I say, it's not just women that banter badly serves. It's men that are served badly by it as well. And I think that damages society as a whole.
On the topic of what young people are watching on screens,
children's... Yes, because neither of us are, unfortunately, but we can try and experience
children's
it.
Television is struggling for viewers. We'll be on to that next. But meanwhile, some pop songs can be improved to joyous levels by the addition of orchestration. And from the collector's edition of the album Setting Suns, this is The Jam with the orchestral mix of Smithers Jones.
He's heading for the Waterloo line to catch the 8 a.m. fast. That's usually dead on time. Hope it isn't late, got to be there by 9. Pinstripe suit, green shirt and tie. Stops up at the corner shop to buy the Times. Good morning, Smithers Jones. How's the white van home? Did you get the car you've been looking for? Did you get the car you've been looking for? Let me get inside you. Let me take control of you. We could have some good times. On this one, we won't get you down. I'll give you a new meaning to life. I don't think so. Sitting on the train, you're nearly there. Line. You're the same as him, you're like tin sardines. Get out of the pack before they peel you back. Arrive at the office, spot on time. The clock on the wall has a guest run night. Good morning, Smithers Jones. The boss wants to see you alone. I hope it's the promotion you've been looking for. I hope it's the promotion you've been looking for.
This addition of strings to the Jam Smithers Jones from their lively 1979 album Setting Suns.
Yes, that was lovely. I'd never heard that before until you sent it to me, and I'm a big fan. I mean, I agree with not always the orchestra.
Not always. No.
Can I point to Phil Spector and Let It Be and Across the Universe and some of the unpleasant things that happened there? Yeah. Having said that, the example you pick is a classic of the genre, I feel.
Yeah, and you know, you can go back to the days of ELO and Wizard and Paul Buckmaster's arrangements, orchestral arrangements for Elton John in the early days. These are all splendid uses of orchestration. But you're right. It's not an open box where everything that comes out is marvellous. There's some a right old toot that comes out where people have just thought, this song lacks a bit. Let's stick some strings on it. So
absolutely. And given you know that I'm very fond of 60s instrumentals and easy listening generally, if I think it's toot, then it really must be toot, mustn't it? Really? I would give one example actually of a good album enhanced by strings, which is slightly later actually, because I know I agree with you. Lots of this sort of 70s, 60s, 70s. crazy stuff is an example. An album by a band that I really like called the Delgados, who started off life as a fairly kind of noisy, skronky indie band on their own label called Chemical Underground. They're from Scotland. And they'd done a few albums, largely obsessed around cycling. So there was one called Peloton and one called Domestiques. But they decided they were going to do an album called The Great Eastern, and they decided to put string arrangements on things. And I remember an interview with one of them, it might have been the singer, who said that we're not professional musicians. So he said it was very difficult when we wanted to describe what they, you know, what they wanted to the people arranging the strings. They kept saying things like, oh, we needed to be a bit ooh and then slightly ah. But somehow the arrangers managed it, and it is a wonderful album that's got some beautiful string arrangements on it. And famously, it lost the Mercury Music Prize by one vote, I think, that it lost the Rally Drawn Boy by one vote in 2000. But it is a wonderful album, an example actually that if you do want to expand your sound by introducing strings, it can even polish up slightly noisy, inhospitable indie bands as well.
This week, your Stuart Heritage writing in Your Guardian.
Yes, he's not always my Stuart Heritage, but I like him more often than not.
Well, he wrote a piece about a serious decline in the viewing figures for the children's TV show Blue Peter. Now, we know we have many listeners outside the UK, so I'll just quickly say that Blue Peter, a light magazine-style show aimed at school-age young people, it's on the BBC and used to be hugely popular. Now, the BBC press office have questioned the viewing figures that the Guardian used by pointing out that they haven't taken into account iPlayer and other platforms into account. Mm. But what isn't disputed is that programmes aimed at that 4:30 to 6 p.m. slot for young people used to hold millions and millions of young viewers captivated. Now, they only attract a tiny proportion of those numbers. Jules, it's time to accept the inevitable. Switch off the life support to Blue Peter and children's television.
Well, and it's interesting you can say this, and I found the Stuart Heritage piece very interesting, actually. It is true that we live in a multi-channel age, and perhaps that means that children consume television differently. So, you know, it's not a case of making sure you watch Newsround. I have to say, I've quite enjoyed Newsround as an adult as well as the child, because in a way that they released a brilliant guide recently, by the way, the producers of Newsround, aimed at children, saying what to do if you feel that you're upset by the news. And I know many adults that have found a great deal to enjoy in this. And my friend and I always used to laugh about Newsnight in the Newsround in the 90s. The idea that it tried to give young, I think it's a great program, it tried to give young people a spread of news stories, which meant often you had these very bizarre juxtapositions where you'd have a long piece. I remember watching a very long, harrowing piece once about kids in Ethiopia, and they followed one boy's story, did not have enough to eat, and it was horrible. And then towards the end of the program, they had one of those, today a panda tied a ribbon, here is Jinping in a zoo in China. And my friend, we used to always enjoy, they'd have captions along the bottom of the screen, and so they'd say, and you know, there's been another missile strike in wherever it was today, and underneath it would say things like war is bad or something underneath. My friend would always say it's the inevitable liberal bias of the BBC. But when it comes to children's TV and investment in it generally, it's very interesting that at the same time as this Blue Peter story appeared, or around the same time, there's a story, again, from My Guardian, but it's a news story rather than a comment piece, saying that the BBC has vowed a multi-million cash injection for British-made children's TV shows. It says that the annual children's budget will rise from £110 million to £124.4 million, with a pledge to spend £31.4 million of that online, interestingly. And it says that it's the biggest investment in homegrown children's content in a generation to keep up with the shift to online viewing and fight the influence of shows backed by US rivals such as Netflix and Amazon. And we've talked about, you know, online viewing platforms and TV on demand before. And it says, spending on British-made children's TV programme by UK broadcasters such as BBC, ITV and Channel 4 has plummeted in the last 15 years, while services such as Netflix has plugged the hole by funding increasing numbers of original commissions for children. And I actually think this is quite interesting, that you might, it's almost like a chicken and egg situation here. Are we saying that that the funding by the major broadcasters in kids TV decreased because there wasn't the provision for it? Or are we saying, in fact, that there have been less viewers of children's TV because there has been less of it? And the fact that people like Netflix have felt that they can and should step in suggests that there is, in fact, a market for it out there that's not being tapped. I think that's quite an interesting argument. And just because people consume stuff online now, maybe like we say, that we shouldn't stop making children's TV altogether, because obviously there is clearly a provision for it and always will be. I know a lot of people that are very fond of Hey Dougie, by the way, and I include myself in that. There was an excellent American TV program for children called Yo Gabba Gabba, which was dead good, frankly. And so there is stuff. The BBC have remade Danger Mouse recently. That is excellent for adults as well as children. So I could do a very celebrity name dropping. I'm gonna name drop here and say the reason that I knew that it was being remade is that we were talking to a very nice man watching football at Lewis once that said, with someone asked him what he was doing next week, and he said he was narrating the new Danger Mouse, and told us that it had Alexander Armstrong and Kevin Eldon in it, and the man in fact turned out to be Dave Lamb, the voice of Come Dine With Me and various things. So that's how I knew Danger Mouse was being remade, which makes me seem far more snazzier and well connected than I actually am. But I wonder if the fact that people that all major broadcasters are looking to compete with each other, which is what's happening here, to move content online as well as sitting alongside existing platforms. I don't think we should scrap children's TV altogether, but I think it is telling that it is moving online rather than necessarily everything being plummeted into usual TV. And I still think, and we talked about this previously, I think we had this in the context of a conversation about, you said, about people listening to the radio and why bother with live radio, should it just be on demand? And I think I pointed out there are actually a lot of people from perhaps more, particularly workmen, I think, and people from literally more working backgrounds that still consume things in that way. And I know that I know lots of people of all sorts, of all kind of incomes, that have smartphones and whatnot nowadays. They are the new normal. I don't want to fall into this ridiculous flat screen television folk devil debate that often seems to arise nowadays.
They're all on benefit, but look at them with their big flat screen TVs.
I know, the flat screen TV gets such a bad rap.
You can't buy those big old fashioned TVs anymore. That's the issue. So
everybody, cheap TV, absolutely. It's like rocking horse dung. Funnily enough, the best flat screen TV joke I've heard in ages was I saw Owen Jones speak a few months ago, who I go on and off a bit, but he gave quite a good speech, and he was having a bit of a rant, and he said, oh, you know, people talk about this and that and immigrants living in mansions entirely made of flat screen television. Every time I think of flat screen TV, I think of a house being lived in by people on benefits made of flat screen TV. But I think that there is obviously still a place for kids TV. I think there will always be a case, as long as there is always TV, I think there'll always be a place for kids TV. And I think that, you know, kids are, I try and view kids as small people rather than necessarily a different race, but their interests may well be different to you and mine. I find certain things on TV, you know, I can't always say that 50 minutes of Newsnight fills me with great joy, so I wouldn't expect small children to sit through it, but I think that it's the right thing to do to have kids TV. But I think that to rationalise your funding by perhaps moving with how children consume that TV is a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, the platform argument is actually a worthy one. And we have to see that it's just one of those inevitable changes with the times. When I was preschool, we had Torchy the Battery Boy, the Wooden Tops, and then
the fact that you had television is quite impressive, I think.
Well, I was about 3 or 4 years old before we got TV.
But that was exceptionally mean of me. That was meant to be quote unquote just bands, but it didn't.
No, it was absolutely true. No people. No, the majority, I think, people in our street didn't have a TV in the early 1960s. It was really mid-60s when it became normal that, you know, every house had one. But, you know, what the TV companies used to do then, after the Wooden Tops, the TV companies used to... BBC One used to just close down for the afternoon and there was nothing else. And they used to think that they knew what was best for us. But in 2017, I think Blue Peter and its children television companions... we have to accept that they are competing with Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, and in particular, I think, more towards your point, Facebook Live and YouTube. And
it depends how old the children are, I think, as well. Think for very young children, CBeebies still seems to be an enormous plank in the platform of my friends, small children, and my friends who have to sit through hours of In the Night Garden as a result.
But if we look at the, for example, the Blue Peter audience, let's say a 12-year-old, most 12-year-olds today, given the choice between watching some grinning 25-year-old feeding a tortoise or... watching some viral clips on YouTube or posting an update on Facebook, the tortoise is going to lose. And...
absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong, Helen Skelton abseiling is a really, really vital thing. But, I don't disagree with that point.
I think it's rather... it's like the horse and cart, wind-up gramophone players, penny-farthing bicycles. Life moves on, and maybe Blue Peter in traditional TV is now a penny-farthing, a relic, in terms of being on traditional TV. But perhaps, as you rightly pointed out, and I must admit I hadn't really considered until you explain that it's about the platforms now, and if they move on to digital platforms and if they make Blue Peter cool and it's on YouTube or Facebook Live, maybe the content then will attract a new generation.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the best way forward, isn't it? Although I would still make the point that not everybody... I still don't think everybody can afford that. So I wouldn't want... No. I think television is a remarkably... it's sneered at by lots of people, but it's actually a very democratic thing. And I'm always interested in the fact that Clive James is seen as one of the great TV critics. But for me, the two of the people whose writing on TV I've enjoyed the most in the last couple of years, Grace Dent used to have a TV column and Caitlin Moran had a TV column. And I have to say, it was very telling to me that two women from very working class backgrounds, one's from Wolverhampton and one's from Carlisle, the fact that they came, the fact that the people that I felt were able to criticise television whilst celebrating it, whilst not looking down on it and whilst realising its power, are women from working class backgrounds. If anyone's interested in reading about television and thinking about the idea of television and its impact on society and, you know, how democratic it is, I read a great book a couple of years ago by an academic called Joe Moran. I think he's got connections to the Liverpool type area, and it's called Armchair Nation, and it's a sort of a story of television. It's quite a long book, but it's really worth reading because I think it's incredibly interesting. And he's someone whose thoughts I would like to hear on children's TV. I think there's a chapter on children's TV in that book. So I'm always a great defender of television, despite the fact that I am, you know, it would seem from my new glasses, self-starting myself as an intellectual nowadays. I've always been an enormous fan of TV and very cross with people that look down on it. So I'm always very defensive of the idea of TV being mucked around with. But equally, I do... or treated as a lesser form. But equally, I do agree that things are changing and there needs to be more emphasis on how that content, the way in which that content is consumed.
Assuming you're not the newest and coolest presenter on Blue Peter, where...
That'd be well good, actually, but I don't think I'd last very long.
Where might we find you this week?
Well, if we're recording this on the morning of Sunday, the 9th of July. I'm DJing at a Labour benefit this evening because we are reliving Labour history. I'm DJing at the Red Hot Labour Party party in Hastings at the Palace, doing a 70s set. I've been dared to play Things Can Only Get Better by various people, but we've come to the conclusion that it will be funny briefly, but perhaps the long-term health benefits of that will not be enormously great. So I'll be doing that this evening. It's between 7 and 11 down at the Palace. There are other DJs, including Wendy May of Locomotion fame. So there'll be a lot of really good stuff going on there. Indie Wonderland this week, 8 to 10 p.m, barricaderadio.com. On Wednesday, doing Indie, Alt Rock and Miscellaneous. And I suspect by the time we meet again, it will be before the next Saturday social, so I can tell people about that then.
Okay, thanks to the extraordinarily excellent Rona, of course.
Absolutely, yep, couldn't agree more.
And to play us out, a solo venture from a member of the Raconteurs.
Yes, indeed, although this was pre-Raconteurs. So this chap was a solo person before then. I think this is beautiful sunny pop, and whenever the sun comes out, I always want to hear something like this. I think it's a great tune, and it's a chap called Brendan Benson, who, as you rightly say, is a raconteur with Jack White. I just love this. There's not much more I can say about this other than the fact that I think that it's terrific. It comes from, I don't know if it was his first, he was someone I think who was plugging away with albums for a number of years before he actually kind of got anywhere really, in true American troubadour style, I think. But he joined the Raconteurs in 2005. This comes from his album Le Palco, which came out in 2002. It was his second solo album, and I think it's terrific. It's called You're Quiet.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.